Rendez-vous de la Francophonie is an annual celebration that promotes the French language, heritage, and its numerous cultural expressions. It runs March 3rd to 23rd in communities across Canada. La Fondation canadienne pour le dialogue des cultures, in partnership with the National Campus and Community Radio Association, through the Community Radio Fund of Canada and this station, present the RBF series, January through March of 2016. For more information, check out www.ncra.ca/RBF.
Okay, Terrence, we got to, sorry, I got to break in on that point of team, the no campaign that they brought back from the dead. We are ready to make now that final projection on the evening. CBC Decision Desk calling for a no victory numerically tonight. It's going to be a squeaker, maybe as much as one percentage point separating the two sides by the end
of
the
evening. That clip is of Peter Mansbridge of the CBC, announcing the results of the 1995 Quebec referendum that nearly split Canada in two. A political group called the Sovereigntists came within 50,000 votes of declaring the province of Quebec to be an independent country. My name is Tristan Koster, and this is a documentary from CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, where we will explore the complicated motivations between two national referendums on Quebec sovereignty over the course of nearly six decades. To get the historical context of the sovereignty movement, I went to see André Lamontagne, a professor of French literature at UBC in the French, Hispanic, and Italian Studies department.
Okay, well, they had kind of a declaration of independence in 1837-38. So we remember the repression from the British Army at the time. And so these patriots were defeated by the army. There were some villages that were houses they were set fire to, and there were some people were deported. There were some executions too.
This led to the Durham Report, a report by Lord Durham, a British politician, whose conclusion was that in order to avoid rebellion, the necessary thing to do was to eliminate French culture in Canada, to essentially force everyone to speak English.
So following that, you had some historians that the historians were very important. It was basically, it was almost literature. It was written in a romantic mode, but they were read by many people. So there were these historians that wanted to people to know about the history of this country, how everything happened, and so on. Basically, in reaction to the Durham Report, you have these historians. Beginning of 20th century, you have also these historians and kind of a survival mentality that was developed. And then the poetry, it started what we call in French la littérature du pays, like this kind of nationalist literature, started with poetry. It was mainly in the late 50s, early 60s, that you had this nationalist poetry, what we call the national text, and littérature du pays with Gaston Miron and other people, and then a few novels. There was a very famous poem by Michel Lalonde called Speak White. It's very famous in the literature, and it's a very interesting poem, Speak White, because it's Speak White. It was an offensive way of saying to people in Quebec to speak English. So let's say you were in Montreal in one of these big stores like Eaton's, and you were trying to be served in French, so people could say that to you, Speak White. So, and it was something that was even used in the parliament in Ottawa many years ago. But it was not easy to be a francophone in the 1950s or 60s. There was a lot of discrimination when you look at the salaries. And there were some francophone neighborhoods when there was a fire, there were no firemen around.
Pierre Renaud is the artistic director at the Francophone Cultural Center in Vancouver.
You know, I mean, the Quebec that my parents know. So we've all known the stories of how Quebec used to be, but things are started to change in early 60s with what we called in Quebec the Quiet Revolution.
The Quiet Revolution was a decade of political and cultural upheaval in Quebec, started by the election of John Lesage and the Provincial Liberal Party in Quebec. It was a period marked by secularization and nationalization of education, healthcare, and hydroelectricity. And it sparked a new cry by Francophones for an independent and self-determining Quebec.
And it was really a radical transformation of Quebec society, led by Jean Lesage. He was elected in 1960 and nationalized a lot of sectors of the society. So, and they created a lot of tools and means by which French-speaking Quebecers could start to be entrepreneurs and get really some form of economic power.
Along with its fortunes, Quebec nationalism exploded. Then, in July 1967, during Canada's centennial celebration and the Expo 67 in Montreal, visiting French President Charles de Gaulle emerged onto a balcony at Montreal City Hall to a crowd of 1,000.
Vive Montréal.
And he said this.
Vive le Québec! Vive le Québec libre!
Long live a free Quebec. It became a rallying cry for separatists and incensed Anglophones across Canada. Here again is André Lamontagne, professor of French at UBC.
You had then the students who were already revolting against the church, the tradition, so on. And then in after 1967, it was kind of a boost, what the General de Gaulle said.
At the same time, another hero of Quebec, René Lévesque, was putting together a political party that continues to dominate in provincial politics in Quebec. Le Parti Québécois was formed with support from all political sides and promised a referendum on Quebec sovereignty and a new era of accountable politics in Quebec.
So René Lévesque was instrumental in the nationalization of the hydro. And so he was fighting for against all these Anglophone companies that had the kind of a monopole of the hydropower in Quebec. So René Lévesque was the force behind this. So people had a positive view of him when he was a liberal. And Lévesque was probably more of a centrist than Bourgault, and he wanted to have a large coalition. So the Parti Québécois, as the name says, it's more like a big tent.
The separatist movement reached a fever pitch, but the quiet revolution was doomed to end in crisis.
And the atmosphere in Quebec is far from permissive, as the arrests mount into the hundreds and the searches into the thousands. The soldiers police and the police search. Canada waits to hear why the War Measures Act has been invoked for the first time in peacetime and why the Canadian Bill of Rights is suspended. That evening, Canadians from coast to coast listen while the actions of his government are explained on national television by Prime Minister Trudeau.
At the moment, the FLQ is holding hostage two men in the Montreal area, one a British diplomat, the other a Quebec cabinet minister. They are threatened with murder. Should the governments give in to this crude blackmail, we would be facing the breakdown of the legal system and its replacement by the law of the jungle.
This was not the beginning of the FLQ crisis, but rather a dramatic escalation. Le Front Libération du Québec was a violent separatist group responsible for bombings across Montreal and the death of at least 7 people. In October of 1970, they kidnapped 2 government officials, James Cross and Pierre Laporte. It met with a swift and severe reaction from then Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau. Cross survived, but Pierre Laporte was found murdered. His body was found in a car in Montreal. In the end, 6 people were charged with the kidnapping of James Cross, 2 were charged with the murder of Pierre Laporte, and dozens of other FLQ members were arrested. Public support also plummeted, effectively ending the FLQ.
And there were many things that were not said about that period. For example, Laporte was under inquiry by the RCMP for corruption. right? People used to talk, people in those circles were calling him Mr. 10%, because 10% was the cut he was supposedly taking. And now that that with the access to all these documentations, we see that it's true that he was under inquiry by the RCMP, because they were following him in the streets of Montreal, and he was meeting people from the Italian mob in Montreal. So he had kind of doubtful contacts, if you want. But people were really stunned when they saw the body in the car, in the trunk of the car. There were newsreel pictures of that, and people were very shocked by that. They say, "Oh, okay, it's some of our kids who did that, right? Students and everything. And now it went too far with the murder of Laporte. So they lost support there. That's for sure."
Despite the setback of the October crisis, René Lévesque and his separatist Parti Québécois went on to form their first government in 1976. The first referendum in Quebec on Quebec sovereignty would occur in 1980. Tensions were high and the politics became divisive between separatists led by René Lévesque and the Parti Québécois, and federalists who favored unity and were led by the charismatic Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Prime Minister of Canada, who, despite his use of the War Measures Act during the October crisis, was still extraordinarily popular across Canada and in Quebec. Pierre Renard was too young to vote in the 1980 referendum, but he remembers the time well.
Two major political figures, Pierre Trudeau on one side, René Lévesque on the other side. And we all felt that they were speaking on the name of, French-speaking Canadians. But then they really polarized Quebec society. On one side, there were people who were in favor of Trudeau. On the other side, people who were in favor of what René Lévesque wanted. I mean, the fact that you're voting yes or no was such a big deal in my own family, because I come from a very, very, very liberal federalist family. And at that time, out of my five siblings, three of us were in favor of Quebec becoming a country, and I was one of them. And my mother was horrified, and it was, we used to argue and fight.
Despite strong momentum, the pro-separation side lost by a wide margin. They only gained 40% of total votes. It was a dearly felt blow, but René Lévesque still remained defiant. In his concession speech after the loss, he addressed the applauding crowd and said,
"Si je vous ai bien compris, vous êtes en train de dire à la prochaine fois."
My friends, if I understand you correctly, you are saying, until next time.
What happened really in 1980 was that pretty much, anyone in Quebec who was, most of the intelligentsia was in favor of Quebec independence. And losing the referendum created such a climate of desperation and such a climate of defeat. Everyone got depressed, very depressed. I remember that very well. A lot of those people who were so politically involved started to withdraw, and they didn't know what would be next. Like, what more can we do? If people do not want Quebec to become a sovereign country, what's the path to follow? All around the world, there was such a dark mood in the early 80s, and it's just a coincidence that the defeat of the referendum kind of accentuated in Quebec this kind of no future feeling there was. But at that time, I was a young student in political science at the university in Quebec City, and I remember we would wear only black. It was also the beginning of or perceiving issues as being global or played on the world stage. And then I think people kind of forgot about the fact that, something should be done about Quebec becoming a country or not.
Even after losing the referendum, René Lévesque continued with his big tent approach. Progressives of all stripes felt they had a voice with the Parti Québécois, even if they wished Quebec to remain within Canada.
After the failure of the referendum, Canada's Prime Minister Trudeau felt that it was silly that we had a constitution that we could not amend because it was of a law of the British Parliament. We were still, you know, our constitution was still in the hands of the British Parliament, and it was a British law. So there were, again, a lot of, well, for the first time, I would say there was a first round of negotiations. And Quebec, even René Lévesque, who was for Quebec independence, decided to participate in the process. And there was a feeling that, well, the referendum didn't work, but maybe this, in this process of repatriation of the Constitution, maybe some things could be changed and for the better. So he kind of gambled on that. And at the end of the day, he felt like he had a lot of support from other provinces. And then happened what we call in French, la nuit des longs couteaux, the night of the long knives.
Trudeau gambled with Lévesque. He stated that if the provinces could not agree with the federal government on terms, then it would go to a referendum. Lévesque, being the great Democrat, could not say no, but the other provinces didn't want to compete against Trudeau's popularity. And in what came known as the Kitchen Accord, they negotiated in back rooms of their hotel without the Quebec delegation, who were staying in a hotel across the river. Lévesque went back to Quebec and flat out refused to sign the Constitution. To this date, no Quebec premier has endorsed the 1982 Constitution. Trudeau went on to retire in 1984. Lévesque governed until 1985, until waning support in his party and a severe health problem forced him to retire. He died 2 years later on November 1st, 1987.
And in 1984, Brian Mulroney became the prime minister. He was elected in the landslide. He said, I'm going to make sure that Quebec signs the Constitution and we'll have an agreement under my mandate. So the first round of negotiations was Meech Lake. That negotiation involved only the premiers of each province and territory and the prime minister. So it was very much an agreement between politicians.
Those negotiations originally favored Quebec's conditions for signing the Constitution, but it was derailed by Manitoba and Newfoundland, who were angry at the lack of consultations with women and Aboriginal groups. Even Pierre Trudeau emerged from retirement to denounce the deal.
Meech Lake was dead. Mm-hmm. And that created like a tsunami in Quebec. A tsunami because people felt like they might speak the real voice of what English Canadians believe and think, and they will never accept the recognition of Quebec as a distinct society. So after the rejection of Meech Lake, it was a tsunami in Quebec. Many MPs who were part of the Liberal Party or the Conservative Party, they left their respective party and they formed the Bloc Québécois, which would be a party that would promote Quebec's independence in the House of Commons.
A second deal, the Charlottetown Accord, also failed, this time in a national referendum. It was the final blow for Mulroney's conservative government.
And, well, in 1993, we know what happened. The conservatives were very severely defeated. They went from a huge majority to two seats. The Bloc Québécois became the official opposition in the parliament.
To put that in context, the second most powerful political group in Canada were dedicated chiefly to seeing Quebec become a separate country. There was also a huge surge for the Parti Québécois, now under the leadership of Jacques Parizeau. And after the 1994 provincial election, the PQ were once again the government in Quebec. And the stage was set for the second referendum in 1995. For the second referendum, which came in 1995, separatists were once again facing off against a Liberal Party, helmed by Jean Chrétien, who was deeply involved in the No campaign of 1980. Jean Chrétien was also one of the key negotiators in the 1982 repatriation and one of the ministers present during the Night of the Long Knives. And he was not about to play nice. There were a great many accusations of cheating against the federal government. They spent huge amounts of money on pro-unity propaganda and even went so far as to fly Canadians from across the country into Montreal for pro-unity rallies.
People were upset by two things. One was the disbanding of the federal government, but the Chrétien government in Ottawa decided, well, we're here to save the country, you know, we don't have to abide by these rules. So they use a lot of money for publicity about Canada, and they say, no, we're kind of above that. And they did that kind of love-in in Montreal when they flew people from all provinces. And I know people from Vancouver who were flown there to participate in a rally. So it kind of offended people.
The dissatisfaction with the results was perhaps most vividly expressed by Jacques Parizeau during his concession speech.
C'est vrai qu'on a été battu au fond par quoi? Par l'argent puis des votes ethniques, essentiellement.
That was him on election night saying, why did we lose? Because of money and immigrants. That statement requires a bit of an explanation. One of the federal government's other tricks had been to fast-track citizenship applications of immigrants in Quebec, especially ones from countries that did not speak French. The reason behind this is because, according to polls, those immigrants were by far more likely to vote for a unified Canada.
Numerically tonight, it's going to be a squeaker, maybe as much as 1 percentage point separating the two sides by the end of the evening, but no more than that. 96.4% of the polls, I can't remember covering election ever, but we have to wait this long to make a projection. It gives you an indication of just how close things were tonight. In the province of Quebec, more than 92% of Quebecers voting. Here's the scene at the Yes Side headquarters, the dejection on their faces of coming so close, so very, very close to their goal. That's the scene at Yes Side.
Yes, I mean, what Jacques Parizeau said that night, he lost because of money and ethnic votes, which was a really, I think he probably regretted saying that for many years after, but it was true. We all know it was true. I mean, if I don't think the fact that hundreds of thousands of Canadians were flown to Montreal by the federal government on the eve of the referendum, maybe it changed a few hundreds of thousand votes, but that's how the yes and no issue was decided, by a few thousand votes. But at the end of the day, sure, I mean, the federal government did something that was probably illegal, and definitely not respecting Quebec's jurisdiction in terms of organizing elections and defining what's legal or not legal in the political process.
For many, the loss in 1995 was the final nail in the coffin for sovereignty. But sovereignty is not entirely dead. The Parti Québécois is still the official opposition.
But for the Parti Québécois, they could come back in power at any time. Mm-hmm. Because in 76, René Lévesque was elected. When they were elected for the first time in 76, they were elected because for the first time they promised that the vote during the election was a vote for a government and there would be a referendum on the sovereignty issue. I don't think Quebecers want to see their politician spending time in Ottawa just to oppose. They want to be, they feel that they have a lot of common issues with the rest of Canada on so many aspects. And I don't think I'm naive when I'm saying this. I mean, there's so many global issues. A lot of things that are on the front page, they concern Quebecers as in the same way they concern people from the rest of Canada, from the west of or the rest of the world. So I think there is a feeling now in Quebec that they want their MPs to work with the federal government so that Canada can play a role on the world stage. I go to Quebec every year and I see that change and I hear it. I hear that change and whenever I watch any you know, TV program from Quebec and so on, you see that this
what Quebec's intelligentsia was preoccupied with in the 70s, that has changed a lot.
Early 80s, that first referendum, families were torn apart. In 95, it was different. It was much more different. Nowadays, I've never heard, and it's been a very, very, very long time since I've heard people debating that issue seriously. Like, they really, really care, or they won't talk to you if you're not on the same side, or it's, that has changed so much.
There is no way to understate the effect that La Belle Promesse has had on Canada. Since our inception, Quebec has been a check on federal power, home to our greatest leaders and artists, and an extraordinary example of democracy at work. Despite early attempts to stamp out Francophone culture and language, they have flourished and become an essential thread in the Canadian story.
Mais j'avoue que ce soir, je serais bien mal pris pour vous dire exactement quand ou comment. La seule chose que je voudrais ajouter, c'est ceci. Avec la même fondamentale confiance en nous et tenant compte du fait que demain, il faut continuer à vivre ensemble et qu'il y a très évidemment de grosses divisions entre nous, est-ce qu'on pourrait terminer un peu cette soirée en chantant pour tout le monde ce qui reste la plus belle chanson québécoise à tous, sans exception, à tous les gens de chez nous. Si quelqu'un voulait l'entonner, moi, les gens du pays, moi, je suis pas tout à fait en voix, là. Gens du pays... Allez! C'est votre tour.
I would like to thank André Lamontagne, Pierre Rivald, and Michael Bédard for contributing their time and stories to this documentary. My name is Tristan Koster, and this has been a production of CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia.
For more information on the Rendez-vous de la Francophonie, which is an annual celebration in partnership with La Fondation Canadienne pour le Dialogue des Cultures, the National Campus and Community Radio Association, Community Radio Fund of Canada, and this station, visit www.ncra.ca/RVF.